I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation, fast, free, global, and open, like the internet, at radioopensource.org. It's close to doctrine here that the best novelists are the true historians of any era and the prophetic voices. We're engaging two of them this hour, the Israeli author of short sudden fiction and some graphic novels, Edgar Keret, in Tel Aviv, and the Palestinian who grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon and is never long away from his family there, Samir El Youssef, who joins us from London. We read their letters to each other on Lisa Goldman's blog at the start of Israel's war on Hezbollah, and we're asking this hour not to cover the war or even explain it, but to lead us by the imagination through the folly of it to some other understanding. Join the conversation through our website, www.radioopensource.org. Edgar Keret and Samir El Youssef, thank you so much for joining us. You may say hello to each other, you may interrupt each other, you may agree or disagree with each other at any moment. I'd like to ask you both, maybe start with you, Edgar, you know, from Homer to Whitman to Stephen Crane in the American Civil War to Hemingway. What's your model of the author in war? What's the author's job in the middle of a war?
Well, frankly, I'm a little bit pessimistic about the ability of writers to stop a war. You know, I don't know any good short story or poem that saved a life or stopped somebody from bleeding or stopped a grenade from going off. But the best that a writer can do, he can put a mirror in front of a nation or a group of people and just say to them, this is how it looks like, you know. I don't think that a writer can do much more than that.
That's a lot. What would you tell us today? What would you tell Israel? What would you tell the world, the Middle East of all stripes, that it looks like today, humanly?
Well, basically, you know, the thing that I feel the most about this war is that some wars, there are many reasons for a war, but this war is almost kind of a psychological motivated war. I think that it was very important for the Israelis to feel that they can go to war against the Hezbollah, or go to war against Lebanon. And even though that there will be attacks and there will be fighting on the ground and there will be soldiers killed, they won't break. Because I think that after so many years in which the consensus that was in the Israeli society was completely fractured, I think it actually started in the first Lebanon war and after it with the Intifada, where in the society was almost close to, you know, to a civil war inside it between left wing and right wing. Mm. This war was very important to show that the Israeli society can unite in a situation and kind of feel the same about things. And I must say that this was kind of an a priori thought. In the moment that the war kind of came up with many questions that should be asked, you know, about attacks and the casualties civilian casualties in Lebanon, then I feel that the force of inertia kind of kept people going forward and not asking this question, because they thought that the whole point of this war is to be united and not to be subversive and not to ask the questions that can kind of question its authority.
It sounds like what we would call a pep rally, a war to prove that we're one team.
Yeah, and I think
we can win one. But I mean, did this really have to be reestablished and at this price? I mean, I don't want to argue the war, but I mean, what is the psychology of a war at this cost that to serve that sort of purpose?
Well, what I think is that Israel passed its most difficult year with the disengagement, because the disengagement, you know, brought a great fracture between the right wing, you know, the settlers, and the liberal majorities that wanted some settlement to be taken off, and this kind of a situation, unity was questioned, and actually you really feel it right now that there are people who are there are settlers who refuse to go and fight in Lebanon because they say we won't protect the houses of people living in the north because nobody wanted to protect our houses. So I'm saying the fact that it happened in this certain point, it is because there was a feeling, I think, in Israeli society that something was breaking. There were two halves kind of drifting to opposite direction. And I think that the Hezbollah attack and the fact that they kidnapped Israeli soldiers and the fact, you know, that they, with the Iran support, were basically talking about the destruction of the country and they kept saying that the country is really, really weak and cannot withstand an attack. This was something that kind of caused an eruption of great violence from the other side, kind of saying, hey, listen, you know, we're still the toughest kid in the block.
Samir El-Youssef in London. Go back to the original question. You know, when you think of writers and war, what is the author's job here? Edgar seems to say it's to hold up a mirror and see the face of the warrior or the warrior nation. What's the job for you?
I think it is actually more difficult than that. I think it ought to be more difficult than just sort of holding a mirror to a society. I think, speaking from our experience back in Israel and Palestine and now in Lebanon, it's what happens to the individual, what happens to people in general, if they live in a state of in a continuous state of war. What happens to the individuals? What happens to people in that sense? Mm-hmm. And basically, what war does and what violence does is that sort of somehow it sucks life out of people. And it turns them into sort of, you know, to use a rather sort of unfashionable expression nowadays, is one-dimensional person, individual, or one-dimensional creature, a flat person that has no interest but to survive. I think for a novelist, for an author, a writer who interested in the work of imagination and creativity in general, is in sort of to reintroduce and to affirm the importance of art into life of people, how important art in our lives, not just only the content of it, not only what's happening and meanings and purpose and all that, but also art as form, as sort of various ways and manners of doing things and sort of, you know, looking at things. And that's just to tell them that sort of humanity is not just about surviving. Humanity is not about winning wars. Humanity is not about fighting. Humanity is not about a sort of ultimate purpose like jihad or freedom or democracy or whatever it is. Humanity is far too complicated and too rich and too great with great dimensions. And this can be seen, in my opinion, not just by preaching people about what they ought or not do, but by also introducing sort of models. Certain models that shows the complexity and richness.
We'll come back to that model in just one moment. I just want to say you're listening to Open Source. Samir El-Youssef, you were saying.
Yes, what I was saying is that it is important that through art, through the introduction of art into people's life, that people should understand that there's more to life than just the sort of, you know, the simple meanings, the sort of usual meanings, the usual idea of having a purpose in life and having a certain aim or goal. It is just far too complicated. And it is through art, through the sort of the artwork that we sort of have a sense of the complexity and the ambiguity of the world around us, and not to see things just as either, you know, black or white or this or that or either or. So it is in this sense the whole idea of art as a form, as a product, as a craft in itself, I think it opens the eye to something that is missing, especially to those of us who have been living in a state of violence, in a state of war for quite a long time.
This is completely fascinating. You grew up with memories in the camp, a kind of shared collective memory of Jerusalem under the British mandate. And I wish you'd call on that, because it was a richness in the associations, in the friendships, the relationships, just the pictures, the streets, that informs, it seems to me, a lot of your thinking and your art. But can you summon a story or a moment out of that that shared story?
Well, look, I grew up, I think, in sort of, you know, early 70s in back in southern Lebanon in a refugee camp called Al-Rashidiyya refugee camp. It's about, like, you know, I think 20 miles from the Israeli-Lebanese borders. And in that camp, at that time, it was under the, you know, the control and the charge of the PLO. And the sort of public rhetoric that was dominant at the time, it was a very nationalist, triumphalist kind of rhetoric that talked about, you know, heroism and fighting and resistance and liberation and all that sort of things. And sort of recalling the experiences of all liberation movements in Algeria or Vietnam or all over the world. Now, this kind of rhetoric was really quite alien to the experience of people. You know, that's what I'm talking about here, you know, relatives, about, you know, my parents, my uncles and aunts, the people that I where I was born and grew up, among whom I grew up. And for them, all this rhetoric about national liberation and all this resistance and fighting imperialism and all that was just sort of, you know, so foreign for them. And basically it's not that they disagreed with it. It's not that they disagreed with the political agenda of the PLO. But it was just this kind of language that they just couldn't make sense of it. It didn't mean anything to them. It just was sort of hollow rhetoric for them. And instead, they sort of developed their own way of understanding things. I mean, you know, and a way which is not only just modest and simple, but more to the point, it's not sometimes it's not simple at all. But more to the point, it does try to accommodate the complication situation. And this aspect in particular, I mean, I remember this through sort of, you know, a relative of ours who was really sort of, you know, in a sense, a satirist, a born satirist, in a sense, somebody who likes to make fun of everything, likes to sort of see things, you know, in different ways, in different manners. And in a sort of, you know, his sort of populist way of responding to sort of any kind of claims, any kind of...
So you're going to have to take a short breath right there. We're going to take a very short break and come back. We're talking with novelists as a sort of respite, refuge from war. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the open source blogger-in-chief. This year, Hugh Hefner, Queen Elizabeth II, and Fidel Castro all turn 80, or at least they will turn 80 if Fidel can live through next Wednesday. Past performance being any indication of future results, he will, in which case we are throwing all three of them a birthday party, three people who defined the last century and managed to make it with varying degrees of vigor into this one. Send them a birthday card at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about war through the lens, not of reporting, but the lens of imagination this hour, with an Israeli novelist and a Palestinian novelist who, as it happens, know each other well by now and correspond. Edgar Keret in Tel Aviv and Samir El-Youssef, Palestinian, today in London. Could I just change the subject a little bit and throw it back to you, Edgar? I want to know about your audiences. You're both translated. You write, in a certain sense, for a world audience now. You have readers probably on the other side of the firing lines too. What do your readers expect from your work, from your talent?
I really don't know. I think for me, writing is a very personal experience. Basically, when I write, I feel mostly that I write for myself. And I cannot imagine what people expect from me. I must say that the book that Samir and me co-written was very, very popular and very well reviewed in Lebanon. So it's kind of, there is something very almost ironic about it, you know, that just a year ago they wrote so well about the book that I've written, and right now, you know, it's we are in a situation of war.
Let me sharpen the question with you. I'm thinking that you're a hip writer in the modern forms. You have a big following among the, shall we say, 20-somethings, 30-somethings. Who are their heroes, and what are they making of this world turned upside down? How are they feeling now among their culture heroes about the settlers, about the IDF warriors, about you, about Seinfeld, about anti-war people? Where is their head and heart?
Well, I think that you know that you must remember that the Israeli society is a very fragmented society, in the sense that, let's say, there are many 20-something who see in Seinfeld their hero, and there are many 20-something that see in the rabbi their hero if they're ultra-Orthodox, and there could be 20-somethings who see in Nasrallah their heroes if they are Israeli Arabs who feel unhappy, you know, with their current situation. It's not really a very homogenic society. And I must say that if there is something that I'm very, very happy about, it's that I can get fan letters from settlers, and I can get fan letters from Israeli Arabs, and I can get fan letters from liberal left-wing people, which means that, in a sense, I think that I don't write in this kind of normal route in which you write for one group which you correspond with, but I just kind of, maybe I'm able to write in a way that people who can politically disagree with each other still recognize themselves in that situation.
Where do the people who read you want to see themselves, and where do they want to see Israel in the world?
Well, you know, I must say that Israel is maybe one of the most paranoid countries in the world, and with a good reason. You know, I think Israel and Palestine, there are two nations or two groups of people that really are very much afraid for their existence. You know, Israel, of course, with the history of persecution for Jews and with the big number of wars that we had since our existence, and with people like, you know, the Iranian president who keep reminding us that there are people around us who would really like us to disappear from the face of this earth. So basically, I think that the first wish of every Israeli is to feel and think that, you know, in 50 years this country will keep on existing. And, you know, and I think that maybe for an American looking from a distance say, hey, that's ridiculous, you know, why shouldn't it exist? But I can come up with 5 different scenarios now that will tell you of 5 different ways how Israel can be wiped off this earth, you know.
Interesting. Do you think of 5 different ways it might be reinforced on the map, and not just by warfare?
No, I'm saying, for example, it could be a civil war between the ultra-Orthodox and the secular. It could be an Iranian nuclear bomb falling on our head. It could be an all-out confrontation between us and some sort of, pan-Arab coalition that will fight against us. There are many different situations in which you can really feel that you will be wiped off the map. You know, there is also something about Israel that it's not that it's a country, you know, that was naturally constructed like, I don't know, France or Italy or even the US. There was some sort of a process that kind of a country came out of it. It's a country that is built on an idea that many people don't like, and there's, in the same suddenness that it appeared, it can disappear. It's a country that is really that small, and you can really see it now, that from one border, a group of armed guerrillas, you know, can shoot to the other side of the country. You know, there were missiles that kind of went over the country, missed it, and hit the occupied territories. It's how small this country is. So basically, there is a big fear among Israelis, and it's an inherent fear. You can feel it in every market. You know, it's like you can look at the, let's say, something like the the real estate market. You know, you can buy an apartment that will be worth a lot of money, and then suddenly Haifa will start getting bombed, and the apartment that you bought is really worth half the price, or is worth nothing if it's hit by a missile. It's, you don't really have that sense of stability that I think that you have in most other places.
You wrote about a strange, funny encounter with a taxi driver when your son was, you were carrying your son. Can you tell us that story quickly?
What I said that, you know, there is this thing about it, when you have a child in Israel, you like always to say to him, you know, that when you grow up, you won't have to go to the army because there will be peace, because army, there is a compulsory army service in Israel. And I went with this driver and he said to me, well, you know, maybe you can't say that to your son because for sure, you know, the aggression won't stop. But maybe you can say to him that by the time you grow up, there won't be a country. So you won't have to go to the army because the country will not exist anymore.
Did he smile?
Yeah, but a kind of a bitter smile, I guess.
Samir Al-Yosef, I wonder what's your connection? What is the connection you're trying to strike between you and your audience?
Well, I mean, basically, I mean, I consider myself as a writer who is a sort of try to sort of oppose or to contradict what my audience, I would consider my sort of general audience expect from me. I mean, my audience is not just a Palestinian or an Arab audience. It could be in Palestine, Lebanon, in the Arab world, or also in this country, in Britain. So and usually when, as a Palestinian author, it is, you know, you are expected to sort of perform a certain, you know, play a certain role and say certain things that I usually said before so many times. And basically to sort of play the role of the victim, the dispossessed and the displaced and the refugee and et cetera, with a sort of, you know, the expected, you know, expressions and means of expressions that are available. I try to sort of, you know, not just to in order to contradict and to sort of, you know, be a contrarian to the audience. I sort of try to introduce, you know, things that you know, often are excluded from talking about Palestinians and Palestine and all this that's relevant to the Palestinian lives, and by doing that, usually it could, you know, prove to be shocking to some to certain you know, certain parts of my audience, whether in the Arab world or even here in England. And you know, I remember, for example, one example that when I was reading parts of my novella, which I considered you know, humorous and a satire, and when I wrote it, I was like laughing all through. And I remember reading it to a British audience, and none of them would laugh. And I thought, well, you know, I mean, does that mean that's the end of my life as a comic writer? Does that mean that I'm incapable of writing comedy? And what happened is that the British audience, the audience who were there listening to me, just because I'm Palestinian, they assumed that my story was going to be a sad story, a story that would make them feel sad and sorry for me. And they just could not see the joke and could not, you know, respond to the joke. And that's one way of, like, you know, that's one of the challenges, I think, that, you know, that as an author I have to deal with, like, you know, to prove to sort of a certain audience, like, as a Palestinian, I am capable of laughing and making jokes, or at least be able to, or trying to make jokes. And it's not only about, look what happened to me and look how what a miserable life I lived in my life, lived over there. So it is, this is one, this is a kind of sort of, you know, rather, I wouldn't say a very harmonious or very sort of, you know, happy relationship with an audience.
I wonder, Edgar Carrot, do you have trouble with people who don't get your jokes? Do you want to try us as a sample?
No, well, you know, again, you know, I think that when I use humor, when I use irony, it's just kind of a way of keeping my self-respect, because if I won't do that, you know, I burst in tears. You know, I always say that humor is the weapon of the weak. You usually make jokes about things that you can't change. You know, it's like when you're in school, you make jokes about your teacher, and when you're in the army, you make jokes about your commanders. You always say, people make jokes about death, so it's kind of, it's really a way of protesting against stuff without kind of becoming too pathetic about it, you know. So I think if my life would be perfect, if I won't have any problems, if I would be happy with everything around me, I wouldn't have to revert to humor.
I'm wondering what you can both tell us about the sort of identity riddles at the core of the war, but also at the core of many artistic lives, too. What do you learn in this kind of crisis about who a man really is? A Jew, an Israeli, a human being, a Middle Easterner, sons of Abraham, or whatever, however you spell it out, how do you think through this awful trap of who each of us is? Edgar?
Well, basically, I think that being a Israel and being a Jew, for many people from outside Israel, you know, I can see that by the Hezbollah, you know, that the Hezbollah, they attacked Jewish communities in Argentina, thinking that they are kind of Israelis, or I don't know from what sentiment this attack came. But being Israel and being a Jew, not only that it's not exactly the same, I think that in many times it's almost a contradiction, because Israel being a secular society, I think that many of the Jewish ideas that that we can encounter with the diaspora Jews don't exist in the Israeli society. You know, Jews are very famous for, let's say, the reflexive humor. Israeli literature is famous for its pathos and not for its humor. Jews are famous for the fact that they were always kind of intellectuals and philosophers and people of the book. But that Israelis are famous for, I don't know, having the strongest army in the world or the best army in the world. So basically, it's not that natural to say, you know, I'm an Israeli and I'm a Jew and it's kind of the same. In a sense, I think that many Israelis want to see themselves as the anti-Jews, because the Jews for them are kind of those people living in the diaspora, being the victims of the Germans in the Second World War, of pogroms in Russia before that, and they kind of want to disconnect themselves from this heritage and create something that is completely different and in some senses the opposite.
And what do you decide you are?
I see myself much more a Jew than an Israeli. And, you know, the thing that I really like about Jews is really that there is something very cosmopolitan about the diaspora Jew. It's like the diaspora Jew was never a nationalist. He was always somebody who, living in a society, being an immigrant, he was always kind of an outsider. He always saw things from the outside. And I sometimes like to say that I feel like a Jew living in the diaspora of Israel, in that sense that I'm a part of the society, but at the same time I can employ this outside perspective that is so typical for Jews, and it's actually this kind of outside perspective that allows them to have the reflexive humor that they're so famous for.
Edgar Carrot, stand by. You are listening to Open Source. Samir El-Youssef, what's the Palestinian version of a kind of self-examination month after month after year after year of who am I really?
Well, I mean, Palestinians have, you know, it was a challenge to forge their own identity as a nation, to prove that they are a nation. And therefore, there was this idea that we are Palestinians, we are a nation, we deserve to have our own state, our own entity, in a sense, our geographical entity, our own territory. And basically the political discourse and the literary discourse, Palestinian discourse, for the last 4 or 5 decades worked on this very issue of sort of asserting the Palestinian identity. Now, this is basically what was a main concern for Palestinians. Now, for people like me, for my generation in particular, having that, you know, sort of, you know, asserted our identity, have convinced everybody that we are a nation, that we have our identity as a nation. The question is that it? I mean, so what? What next? And is that the whole thing? Is just that you assert your own identity? Of course, as you can see, it's asserting one's identity does not necessarily solve the problem, does not necessarily lead to the establishment of sort of, you know, to a just peace, to a sort of a Palestinian state, to end of life of Palestinians living as refugees or living under military occupation or whatever. More to the point is what do you lose in when you just keep asserting your sort of, you know, your identity, your national identity, you know, as a Palestinian perhaps, or even as an Israeli. is there's so many other identities there, so many sort of dimensions to one's identity. I mean, you know, particularly for those of us coming from, you know, from that part of the world where it's a sort of Arab identity and basically the sort of cultural identity, the religious identity, and the sort of local or national identity sort of intermixed together.
And well, I'm dying to know what you make of the sort of cauldron of identities now, and something new being forged in this Hezbollah moment.
This is what's so interesting about it, that you spend like so many decades to try to prove a certain identity, and suddenly the public that sort of whom you've been speaking, trying to assert their identity, suddenly they sort of, you know, show a certain allegiances to a different identity, to a religious identity, for example, not to the national identity, to something more of a cultural or ethnic, for example. This has been happening all over the place. For me, this is proof that, you know, the whole issue of identity is. I mean, I don't want to say dubious, but I would say that one ought to be so cautious about it and not really give it too much credit, because more than once, a nation or a group of people fight for their own identity, and once it has been asserted and proven beyond doubt, suddenly somehow they sort of discredit it, or just sort of, you know, just give, I mean, it's just sort of, it shows that the whole struggle, the whole sort of, you know, bloodshed, that the cost that was paid for it was just sort of somehow useless and pointless. And that's why, I mean, you know, for me, the issue of identity is just, it is a challenge to prove that the whole concept of identity is actually to prove that there is actually no essential or particular identity. And it's always something else that happens.
That's a fascinating circle. And at the end of it, who are you?
Who am I? Yes, well, as Samir or what? Well, I am a Palestinian born in Lebanon, and I've been living in England for so many years, and I'm, legally speaking, I'm a British citizen. So I sort of, you know, I can go on and on telling you about, you know, being a Palestinian from a Sunni Muslim father and a Shiite mother, and then have so many Christian and Jewish friends, for example, lived most of my life with Lebanese, lived a great deal of my life with Londoners. And as you know, London is a kind of city that defies the whole concept of identity, because you.
Well, really, I think this should be the game: is to keep adding, until almost till we lose track. We're talking with two novelists, one Israeli, one Palestinian, during the war, not about it, but maybe through it. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In conversation this hour with two novelists, Edgar Keret in Tel Aviv and the Lebanese-Palestinian Samir El-Youssef in London. A lot of people listening will be reminded, I think, of Edward Said and the pianist conductor Daniel Barenboim, who kind of made a roadshow in the years before Edward Said's death, not just on the trick that one was Palestinian and one was an Israeli, and not even on the trick that they were both artists and both deeply musical, but really on the fact that two people came to have this profound enthusiastic investment in the future of the region, deep knowledge of its history and of the relationship of two peoples in that place. What's the correspondence here? And do you ever think of yourselves as Barenboim and Said?
Samir? Yeah, but I see myself as Said and Samir is Barenboim.
This is good. This is great.
Yes, all right. Yes, I agree with that. I go along with that.
Well, you know, can I? This reminds me of something that Amin Maalouf, the Lebanese novelist, said to me a few years ago before the start of the Iraq War. He said, "I love to hear Jew and Arab debate as long as Arab takes Jewish position and Jew take Arab position. Otherwise, it's all tribal lies and old bullshit." But I think that's great that Samir, you want to be the Barenboim in the conversation.
Well, I mean, we've just been talking about identities. I mean, if you sort of have a real discussion with a Palestinian, and then you listen to all his arguments and his views, you will discover a great deal of what he says actually are taken from Jewish experiences, you know, from the Jewish experience. I mean, for example, this argument for the right to return. If you ask a Palestinian, like, how come, do you imagine after 60 years that you want to go back? I mean, or your parents or your grandparents want to go back? Come on, it's 60 years now. He will tell you, look, the Jews waited 2,000 years to go back. Why shouldn't we wait at least 100 years, for example? So it's like, you know, a kind of Jewish talk adopted by the Palestinians. You know, so it's really very easy for a Palestinian to take on a role of an Israeli or a Jewish person. So it's really very easy. The similarity in the experiences, the similarity in the, never mind the temper and the culture, it's just sort of, you know, it's amazing that it's very easy. You get one confused one with another. I remember, I think it was Edgar who told me this story about, you know, him and the Arab Israeli writer Said Kashoua in France, it was, and they were talking to the public, and somebody, after, like, you know, towards the end of the discussion, one of the audience stood up and said, "Which one of you is Arab? Which one is the Jew?" So basically, it's really very easy to confuse us together.
Edgar, would you agree?
Yeah, I think that really the Palestinian and the Israelis have a lot in common in the sense that we there are both groups of people that see themselves as victims. And in the same time, the group of people that in many circumstances victimizes the other ones. But I think both Palestinians and the Israelis have this perspective that they have this huge fear from genocide. They really think that their history is the saddest in the world. They really think that people who disagree with them are either, you know, anti-Israeli, anti-Palestinian, anti-Semitic, or just anti-Muslim, you know. There are a lot of, I think that there's something in the psychology of the two people that is very, very similar.
We met you on a blog, Lisa Goldman's blog. Our blogger-in-chief, Brendan Greeley, is standing by with a distillation of the blogosphere. Brendan?
We have an argument raging on our blog that I'm wondering if the two of you can help us settle. Joshua Hendrickson wrote this afternoon, "If religion could somehow magically be factored out of the equation, what cultural similarities would remain to bring together the Israelis and the Palestinians?" Jay Dyer logged in right after him and answered, "I think that each side needs time out from the conflict through separation. Right now, they are like a couple stuck in a bad marriage. There needs to be a divorce before there can be some sort of understanding. Only later will they be able to reach out to each other to learn about the history and the culture of the other." So the question is, culturally, what do Israelis and Palestinians need? Do they need a better marriage, or do they need a good, solid, permanent divorce with maybe a 5-year wait and then some phone calls?
Samir.
Well, I mean, I think this is the argument that was introduced by Amos Oz a few years ago. Amos Oz said that, you know, help us to divorce. And my response was at the time, whenever did we get married? I mean, I didn't know that Palestinians really get married. In the contrary, I believe that the problem between Palestinians and Israel is that we never managed to get married. That's a problem. Is that from the beginning, there was separation enforced by violence, by war on the two nations. From the beginning, I mean, I said about my main interest about Palestine and Israel is why didn't the experiment of Palestinian-Israeli life together in one state, it didn't work. Why nothing didn't work? Why it didn't happen? To be honest, not rather than it didn't work. And this is because from the beginning there was a sort of a plan to do this to impose separation by basically violent means and methods. And that's why we are here. It is actually the enforcement of separation. The contrary, I think Palestinians and Israelis are two people who have more than one quality, more than one aspect of their lives that would make them a sort of ideal couple, but they are being separated.
Interesting. And we haven't disposed of the God question yet. There was the marriage image, but also if you could just take God out of it, then what?
I don't really know. I am a thoroughly secular-minded person. I really don't think much about God, to be honest. So, I mean, to tell you the truth, I'm an atheist, so I really can't help you with the question of God.
Edgar?
Okay. I'm a believer.
Oh, no, good for you.
No, I think that God is taking a big role in the conflict right now, because many of the settlers from the Israeli side think that their right to stay in the occupied territory is enforced by God. I think that right now the most destructive forces in the Middle East against reaching a peace are extreme religious groups, you know, of the fundamentalist Islam. You could see the Hezbollah, you could see the Hamas. So I think that, you know, I don't think that if God would be taken out of the equation, things would be solved immediately, but I think that they would become much easier.
Let me go back to the letters you've written to each other. I read them on Lisa Goldman's blog, but you both struck very, very sober themes toward the end. Samir, you wrote to Edgar that you said, neither of us is very keen on late psychoanalysis, but we must admit that emotions have determined great deals of our politics and fate. This is what we need to confront with unwavering honesty when we start talking about peace again. There is such a complete backlog now of awful violence. Where do you locate it? Where do you pin it down? Where do you start treating it before total self-destruction, as you say, is the order of the day?
Yes, absolutely. Why is this fascination with violence? I don't think that, you know, Palestinians and Israelis are particularly more violent than anybody else, or more willing, have a greater desire for violence. I don't think that is the case. Of course, you know, politics, regional and international, has a great role here, and as we can see now, you know, from the American attitude, from the Iranian attitude, from the Syrian attitude, and so on. But let's concentrate on the idea that I'm trying to sort of address in my letter, and that is this belief in the use of force and in violence. Why is it? Why? I mean, there seem to be both. You know, I mean, now if you talk to the Israelis, I mean, you know, quite a, you know, I think the majority of Israelis think that, you know, this is the way to go about it, you know. And if you talk to so many Lebanese, including those who are basically, you know, originally against Hezbollah and against everything to do with Hezbollah and Iran, somehow they would sort of argue that that's the way to go about it, and the use of violence and force. And what I'm trying to say is why is it that we sort of somehow seem to be so keen on the idea of the use of force and a belief in the sort of use of violence as a way of resolving sort of political disputes? And in my opinion, it is something to do with the emotions and with the desire to see sort of the other being humiliated and the other being sort of, you know, beaten. And we know, I mean, I'm sure that most people know that and neither party is going to win this war. We know that. But nevertheless, there is this desire. I mean, this sort of desire. I mean, somebody was telling me a few days ago, like, you know, how much I would like to see that, how much I would like the Israelis to be sort of, you know, to be taught a good lesson, you know, that sort of really to sort of have a bloody nose. And he was saying that because he said that's the only way we'll sort of beat sense into them and make them a bit, you know, get rid of this arrogance and this belief that they are sort of, you know, they are the strongest and they can do everything by violence. And perhaps sort of learn some humility, he was saying. At the same time, I was worried that if that happens, how are we going to control Hezbollah after that, if Hezbollah would manage to do that, for example. So, I mean, basically the point here is that it is the sort of, you know, there is... a sense that the other side is arrogant, the other side is a bully, the other side that need to be taught a lesson, you know? This is the sense that I think it's there. Something that said Edgar early on about, you know, why the Israelis seem to be behind the government in this war, or the majority of the Israelis. And perhaps it's something to do with the lack or the need for unity. But on the other hand, I think it is this sort of desire to sort of affirm that we are still able to fight. We are still able to beat the other side and to sort of, you know, those who want to destroy us, we are able to fight them. I mean, it is, you know, the lack of security within us, the anger, the desire for revenge, all these sort of emotions, I think, are to a great extent are sort of determining our politics in the region and making the sort of, you know, the politics of peace and dialogue and negotiation seems to be sort of either hopeless or at least sort of, you know.
I'm wondering, Samir, how do you handle it yourself when you read of the massacre at Qana, for example? How do you contain your own, you know, first bloodlust for vengeance, even locating it on Edgar's head?
Well, it happens that I remember Edgar, I remember Michal, I remember so many Israeli friends. I know all these people do not approve what's been happening. I know they would be hurt. I know they would be embarrassed and sorry and loathe what's been happening and what their government or what their country is doing. Because I know these people very well. I mean, it is a question of knowledge, isn't it? I mean, the question that you know somebody on the other side who disapprove us, not only disapprove, but is just sort of, you know, totally against it and totally hurt by what's happening.
Edgar, how do you control your own reactions to a bomb or a loss or a grave injury or something?
Well, you know, basically, returning to this discussion about violence, I really think that violence primarily comes from fear, and the fact that both Israel and Palestine and Lebanon, you know, we find ourselves in a conflict or in a situation of war is just because we're really very, very much afraid of each other. I think that, you know, the thing that if you talk to a Palestinian or Israeli and ask them to ask who is the strongest side in the conflict, the Palestinian will immediately say that Israel has this American weapon and they are much stronger than the Palestinians. And the Israelis will say the Palestinians are stronger because they're supported by all the Arab world. There are a billion people around them. We are only 5 million. There are Iranian nuclear weapon being prepared at this time. All those other countries want us completely destroyed. We don't want any other Arab country destroyed. So I'm saying in this equation, I think that both sides think that they are weak, that they are in a very desperate situation, and that the only way of surviving that situation is by employing a force at the other one, attacking because it's your only chance for survival.
Samir said that personal knowledge of the other, knowing you, makes a difference.
Well, for me, no, it's not only knowing Samir, it's just realizing that, you know, that people on the individual level, you know, there are no evil nations, you know, or there are no black and white, like Samir talked about it, you know, there are no Darth Vaders and Luke Skywalkers walking around this earth. There are just people being pushed to some positions, there are just being people who are being miseducated, and of course, you know, their actions in themselves can be horrible, but I don't believe that that mankind is horrible.
You wrote something very sweet, Edgar, in response to Samir's letter at the start of the war, and he hoped he hadn't caused you worse distress than you were undergoing already, and you said quite the contrary. he said, it's daily life here in Tel Aviv with its unending suspicion and hate, which makes me despair, and your letters that fill me with more than a little hope. I guess that speaks for itself, but surely the one-to-one connection may be of infinite value. I wanted to ask you both, going back to Edward Said and Daniel Barenboim, they were really bonded by a passionate enthusiasm for the possibilities of the Middle East. They were also bound, really, also by an understanding of what art does in this sort of a desperate emergency. Would you speak to that a little bit? And where you go for a kind of refuge? Who are the writers? What is the literature? What is the history that somehow not consoles you, but gets you through, keeps you writing? Edgar, who are your models here?
Well, I really love Kurt Vonnegut. You know, I think I learned a lot about writing from him. I really love the way that he uses a sense of humor and irony in such a warm way. You know, in a way that kind of connects between people and not, it doesn't alienate them. I love Kafka. You know, I really find his writing very, very moral too. I like writers that kind of, in a sense, keep surprising you and keep kind of having this effect of kind of waking you up to your own life. You know, it's not just I don't really want to be absorbed into a parallel world with all kinds of, I don't know, different physical laws. I just want somebody to say, hey, you know, look around you, see things in a way that you didn't see them before.
Give Samir 20 seconds for your own refuge from art. Who do you read, Samir?
I basically most sort of modern writers who are very much sort of into who embraced sort of modern consciousness, were very much aware of what has happened to our world.
None of it pretty. We've got to stop, but I'm so grateful to you for giving us this hour. Edgar Keret in Tel Aviv, Samir El-Youssef in London. You can keep talking about novels as a refuge. You can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, and Robin Amer, with help from Greta Pemberton, Henry Shepard, Colin Baker, and Rob Keir. Our closing music was provided by Gerador Zero. Tina Toby was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.